He is one of South Africa's top labor lawyers. He is a politician and member of parliament. And now you can access Michael Bagrum as he talks law and life on High FM. Join Michael Bagrum at 6 p.m. for Bagrum on Law and Life, 101.9 High FM, 101.9 megahertz of life and law.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us this evening. It's Michael Bagrum. We're on High FM 101.9. If you want to send a WhatsApp, it's 061-895-1019. You can email as well. It's bags, B-A-G-S, at High FM, one word, C-H-A-I-F-M.com. Please send us any information that you want to send us, any ideas. If you want me to interview special people, please let me know about it. But thank you for tuning in on this cold evening. I'm talking from Cape Town this evening, and I have a wonderful guest with me. But like I do every week, I look at a book that I've been squizzing through, and I give a little review of it. I've been, in the last few days, been absolutely fascinated. I took a little book out from my bookshelf, which I hadn't read before. It's one of those Penguin classics, a tiny little book. And this one's on Oscar Wilde. And the heading is, Only Dull People Are Brilliant at Breakfast. An absolutely remarkable man and absolutely remarkable sayings. It is fantastic to just go through some of these Penguin classics and have a look at some of the people that we hear so much about, but don't know too much about their writings. I want to just spend one or two minutes saying a quote from him. And he said, to know nothing about their great men is one of the necessary elements of English education, which I was absolutely stunned when I read that. And then he said, we spend our days, each one of us, in looking for the secret of life. Well, the secret of life is in art. So you should take these little books out, have a look at them. I've got a few of them myself. I love reading it. So just a tidbit of information that I think we should just go back to some of the basics of Oscar Wilde. Fantastic man. A few weeks back, I think it was 2 weeks back, we interviewed a fellow, Shawn Benjamin, S-H-A-W-N, Benjamin, B-E-N-J-A-M-I-N. I've had a few people asking me for his email address. If you were one of those people, his email address, and you could write this down, it's Shawn, S-H-A-W-N, at MTB South Africa, or one word, mtbsouthafrica.co.za. He's the one that's actually put those innovative products together for cycling and also for chafing. He does a lot of it through beeswax. He's an unbelievable character, so please get hold of Shawn. It's Shawn, S-H-A-W-N, at mtbsouthafrica.co.za, all lowercase. And you can speak to him about some of the photography that he does that he was speaking about, especially the wildlife photography, and then anything to do with cycling. He's done amazing work. So I told him, rather instead of writing back to everyone, I'll just put his details on air. He didn't have a problem with it. Now, tonight we have another fantastic guest, and we've been blessed in that we've had great people coming forward and willing to be basically cross-examined by me. And tonight I have a fellow by the name of Simon Mantell, M-A-N-T-E-L-L. I came across Simon a few years back. I love listening to his adverts. He puts adverts on various radio stations, and they're all politically based with a certain touch of satire, sarcasm, and reality. And in listening to this, I was always fascinated by these adverts. And, of course, then what did happen through luck or sheer serendipity, Simon did come to me and asked me to do some work for him. We've subsequently become friends. And he's also subsequently sent some amazing people to me to speak to me about their labor problems. And I thought it would be fantastic to get to know the man, Simon Mantell, get to know his current brand and the history in which he got there, and just hear how he's built a business out from nothing, absolutely nothing. He's a born and bred Cape Townian, which makes him fantastic. And he tells me, and I asked him for a brief CV, And at the age of 13, if you tried to do that today, you'd be in major trouble. But at the age of 13, he was selling mirrors door to door. And in 1976, in the newly established Mitchell's Plain. So he went out as a youngster. Today, you get a major fine for that. You even get arrested. You're underage and you can't do that, but that's innovative. He did qualify as a CASA in 1987 and served articles with then Price Waterhouse. He started in 87 a small car wash business with two employees at the Woolworths head office in the basement. And he said he had a laborer appropriately named Gift and then himself. So him and Gift then started that car wash business. His business grew. And then in 1988, he started a pasta and ice cream takeaway business called Mantelli's. Now, remember that name, Mantelli's, Mantelli's. That's the secret business, Mantelli's. And he said that he had an English woman working at one of his takeaways and was a good baker and had an oven the size of a microwave and was mixing was done by hand with a wooden spoon in a plastic bowl. They eventually became the brand that we all know today, and that's Mantelli's Biscuits. And I must tell you, I've been eating Mantelli's Biscuits. Maybe that's the secret to it, but I love Mantelli's. And, of course, he's got a kosher variety of Mantelli's Biscuits. The reality is it's a wonderful business that today has grown to become a very formal big business. He's grown it over the years, and he supplies nationally. Various markets, and he goes supplying elsewhere, USA, Spain, Germany, Finland, all under that private label. Of course, I want to talk to him tonight a bit about his current affairs in our country and some of his op-ed pieces. Before we go there, I just want him to go through that history, his background, and what got him to be an entrepreneur. We don't see many CASAs becoming entrepreneurs. So, Simon, thank you for being with us this evening. I really appreciate it. Over to you. Just give us a little bit about your background.
Hi, Michael. Thank you very much for that kind introduction. I think just to clear up one thing, in 2018, I resigned from SAICA, so I am no longer a CAS. You know, you lose designation. So I don't want to be rejecting that I'm an accountant when I'm not anymore. Yeah, look, I think the important thing that sort of I learned from a young age was that my dad always told me that you generate sales through the soles of your feet. And, education, I think so much emphasis is placed on formal education, but so little is placed on just, I suppose, the kind of the skills of life and being able to sell. And, whatever job you do, whether you're a professional, whether you're a doctor or a lawyer, whatever it is, if you can't get on with people and you can't relate to that side, that becomes the important thing. So for me, the important thing was always being able to sell, whether it's selling yourself at a job interview, selling yourself wherever. And I suppose that was probably the most important thing that I learned. So whilst my dad maybe encouraged me to go to university, I was on my own. I had to get student loans. And I always look at like the young kids of today, how easy it is. I think that one definitely, it's far better to have a little bit of a struggle. And then I found my way. I never ever wanted to be an accountant. It was in those days it was a very good qualification to have. And I always knew that I was going to go into business on my own. And obviously when I started, I didn't have any capital, but the only thing that I did know how to do from being a young boy was I had to wash the cars every week. So that was one skill that I had. And that's where it began. And, one thing has a way of leading on to another. And, I think the big thing about entrepreneurship is being able to identify an opportunity. And then when you see the gap, then being able to find a way to fulfill or satisfy that's the need that people have. And, slowly but surely, I think that one can't emphasize enough that it's real brick by brick stuff. It's not, yes, there might be people if you get really lucky, but, generally it's brick by brick and it takes a lot of time.
Well, you went through various stages. I mean, that you said you first washed cars. Basically, at the end of the day, you landed up selling, which is obviously a big skill of yours. We're going to talk about selling. We're going to take a quick ad break. Can you hold on for 1 minute? We have to pay the bills.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Thank you. You're back with me, Michael Bagram, and my wonderful guest, Simon Mantell. And Simon was just going through some of his background as a fledgling entrepreneur. Simon, in 1988, you started that pasta and ice cream takeaway business. That's when you first called it Mantelli's. I want to know two things. First of all, how did pasta and ice cream go together? I find that a bit strange. And then tell us the magic in going to Mantelli's, obviously from Mantell, your surname, but to Mantelli's. So it's going to have an Italian-type background. Let us in the secret.
Well, so actually what happened was, as a kid, many years ago in Sea Point, there was an Italian takeaway pasta business called Gastronomia. And they did prepared lasagnas and cannelloni. This must be going back 45, 50 years.
I remember them.
I used to go there as a young kid with my father, and we'd get takeaway lasagna. And I had this idea, you know, and I think before you get into food or food manufacturing, you know, it's almost the way people work things out on the back of a cigarette box, and you think it's all going to be easy. And I had this idea. In fact, even when I was at school, I wanted to have Italian takeaway shops, but I knew nothing about cooking, and eventually found an Italian chef. So while I was running the car wash business, which subsequently grew a little bit, I found an Italian chef who then we started these Italian takeaway shops where we did fresh pasta and ice cream. And then that carried on for a few years. And in that stage, that was when an English woman who was working came and ran one of the shops, and she was a good baker, like a domestic baker, you know, and it began out of that. But that's where the idea, and then the name Mantelli's was obviously the Italian thing, and I kept the name, and it just it continued from there.
Okay, so in those early days, obviously you were producing everything yourself, and the biscuits started growing. You started exporting some of these biscuits. Tell us about that. It seems like a very steep curve from just selling ice cream.
Well, you know, from there, and in fact, once again, it's kind of like bucket and spade. You know, from there, if I think about it, we literally, it was DeFi convection ovens. I mean, it was brick by brick. You know, I think that this is the thing that also people don't understand, is that, you know, to start a business, unless you have a silver spoon in your mouth, it typically you bootstrap the thing, and it grew, and it obviously eventually became, it's now a proper industrial setup. But for the first few years, it was really, really hard. You know, I mean, in those days, we didn't have enough space, so we worked a day shift and a night shift. There were no taxis then to take staff home. So I had a little Nissan 1400 Bucky and would deliver staff. The night shift, which was like an early shift at midnight, would drive them home. And it was and I think I can't emphasize enough for people starting businesses, do it, but understand that you've got to put in the hours. So it was a really long process. And then over the years, you know, as you become established in things, you get a little bit luckier and opportunities open up. But if you keep persisting, eventually, you know, the dam wall breaks and you get your opportunities.
Now, Simon, I'm starting a business, and I started my own small law firm, and that's not as onerous as what you were doing, because it basically was office hours, so I was very lucky about that. But it's time-consuming, it's difficult. As an individual with very little help, you're doing your books at night, you're doing your research at night, and you're trying to work during the day. I know you're married, and I know your wife, I think she's an anaesthetist that's still to this day at Shorter's Care Hospital. Didn't that interfere with your private life in those early days?
Well, I think that probably, if I think of the first 10 years, you know, here I was, I'd qualified. I mean, to go to the Spur and have a hamburger would have been a big decision. And, you know, working those hours, I mean, I could hardly keep a pot plant alive, let alone be married with a family. So I actually got married very late. I met my wife, who's Danish, when I was 42, and I only got married when I was 44. So, you know, I think that, and it wasn't ever a case of I felt that I'd given anything up. But, you know, what ends up happening is a business then becomes sort of all consuming. And that's how it is. And, you know, you make choices in life, and certainly I love what I do. But, you know, eventually it got to the point where I was lucky enough to meet Ulla, and we had two kids. So the advantage of that is I'm now 62 and I've got two young daughters, and all the parents of our daughter's friends are all really young. So I have this really nice, I've got my sort of friends from varsity days, as well as these really young parents who are optimistic about life. They haven't been scarred. And, you know, they're building, they're not scaling down, which is, all, you know, it's always refreshing.
Well, okay. So we obviously did some work together. I gave you some labor advice, and we had one or two scraps with other individuals. But that was minor stuff. Where I started taking note was watching some of your adverts. I'm not sure where you're advertising nowadays, but wherever I see a Mantelli's advert, I'm absolutely fascinated. First of all, is it your thoughts? Is it, or do you have a team behind you that's putting together these adverts? Tell us a bit about what's it aimed at, and who designs it?
I think we've always had, we've had fun adverts, and he sadly passed on, but I had a brilliant copywriter called Errol Denman, who... I've always been interested in politics and current affairs, and I'd maybe plant a seed, and Errol would produce these amazing ads. You know, to do an advert in 30 seconds, to put that punchline across, he was just absolutely brilliant at it. And between Errol and there's a guy called Tully McCulloch, your listeners
yes.
might know McCulloch's workshop. Well, Tully's a legend.
Yeah.
In voiceovers, and between Errol and Tully, they just, they had a whole lot of fun. And I think that our adverts have always been a bit of tongue in cheek and poking fun at the politicians and highlighting, you know, all the stuff that is wrong, but in a kind of jovial way.
Well, I must tell you, I love it, and my mates all love it. We share your latest advert with each other. It's nice. It's a sort of sarcasm mixed with a bit of shock and then with a big laugh afterwards. Tell us about one or two of your favorite ones. Do you still recall?
Well, I would say that probably for me, the best advert that Errol did was he did an advert for the Gupta, when the Guptas landed at Waterkloof Air Force Base.
Their wedding,
and, maybe I'll send you the link one day and you can play it for your listeners. Anyway, in a nutshell, the Guptas had landed at Waterkloof Air Force Base for that, for the wedding. And anyway, this ad sort of started with the captain of Jet Airways, which was the airline, asking the traffic control for Bridal Express permission to land. Anyway, and then eventually what happens is they only get permission to land if they bring biscuits up to the control tower. But I mean, just the way Errol worded it with kind of the hint of corruption and malfeasance, I mean, he just had an amazing, amazing way of putting it together. He was brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
So what you've done, for some of our listeners who haven't heard your adverts or wouldn't have seen them, most of our listeners here tonight are in from Johannesburg, but what you had done is you've taken sort of bizarre political incidents in our history, like Ramaphosa's couch and those sort of things, and you've turned it into a bit of a joke, and although it's serious, you've twisted it around to encourage people to buy Mantelli's biscuits. Which to a large degree has worked. It's you're growing, first of all, that tells the story. Obviously, the biscuits are good. I like them. I shouldn't be too many, but I really love them. But the bottom line is, it's because of your interest in current affairs. You're watching what's going on in the country, and you're obviously giving them the tips. Let's do this. Let's look at something to do with that. And it's really spot on. It's current. It's happening. And then comes in Montelli's biscuits. Do you get people commenting?
Yeah, look, sometimes people get a bit mad as well. You know, I've had a whole lot of adverts where I've tackled, obviously, the ANC and Malema. I've had one or two adverts where I've tackled the DA, and I've had irate DA supporters saying they'll never buy our biscuits again. You know, on one or two.
While they're chewing.
But I think all credit, it's not to me, it's to the guys, say Errol, who wrote those adverts, and I've now got a guy called James Burton who writes the ads now, who's equally got a kind of feel for timing. You know, he's just started doing them. So it's definitely not, it's not credit to me.
Okay, now I do know that you, because you and I do WhatsApp each other and send each other articles and whatever, and that your interest in the current affairs in South Africa has led you to write many op-ed pieces for the Daily Maverick, Business Day, Financial Mail. I follow them. But take us through one or two of the hard-hitting ideas that you've had. Do you still recall?
Yeah, look, yeah. Over the years, I've written a ton. I suppose probably my first really serious piece was around about 2012, when one of my staff was the subject of, in those days, it was called emoluments attachments order, which for your listeners, in case any of them don't know, is when people borrowed money, the credit provider, if they weren't paid, could go and get a court order instructing the employer to deduct the money and pay it over to the credit provider. And then I became aware, and in fact, it was a case with African Bank in 2012, where a staff member had borrowed 10,000 rand. They were charged 1,000 rand raising fee, which then got capitalized into the debt. And with all the compulsory insurances and all the things that they needed to do, effectively, their repayment was 1,049 rand a month over 18 months. So basically, they paid 18.
You doubled.
Over 18 months. And, you know, then Marikana happened in 2013, and I wrote about this, and I actually said, you know, this micro-lending as it is what's destroying much of the fabric of our society. And ironically, I look at it, and, you know, if you look at a hardworking blue-collar worker who's got a stable job, it's ludicrous that they should be paid, that the interest rates that they should pay should be any different from a middle-class or upper-middle-class South African. And anyway, it started with that. And, in fact, well, I'm just digressing now, but I think that there's a massive opportunity for, you know, the mainstream banks are getting hammered by Capitec, but typically, you know, most business are banking with the kind of the old Ned banks or Standard banks, et cetera. There should be, what should happen is they should have lending where they manage it through the employers. They know the staff, employers know that which staff are reliable and are dependable. And there's no reason why, there's no reason why a less fortunate staff shouldn't be afforded the same deals that we get when we go to the bank. And there's a way of unlocking that. But anyway, that's for another day. But, you know, I then got involved with IRBA, which is an independent regulatory board for auditors. And what struck me was state capture. I had a matter involving a state-owned entity, which it's been going on for about 10 years now. I then realized just how complicit mainstream South Africa was in state capture and just corruption generally. You know, so often the default setting is, well, it's the Guptas and it's Dudu Mayeni or whoever it is. But, you know, the people, if you look at the State Capture Commission, there wasn't one legal firm that I can remember that was implicated in state capture, as an example. In a similar way, if I look at the audit firms, you know, all the state-owned entities prior to the Auditor General taking over in about 2017, they were all audited by the Big Four. Yet every year, with all this procurement corruption that was going on, these state-owned entities got clean audits. And ironically, if the auditors had done their job properly, they could have audited procurement. Procurement is material within the financial statements of all those state-owned entities. If they'd done it properly, they would have then given adverse audit opinions, and the banks wouldn't have been able to provide funding in terms of their own corporate governance rules. And you would have dried up the funds to the state-owned entities. There would have been no procurement and no corruption until they got their act together. You know, so I think that the problems that we face as a country are, it's also the people who wear double cuff shirts, have plummy accents, have been to all the right schools, have had the benefit of all the education. You know, it's not a case of pointing fingers at someone else. It, you know, it's a joint effort, this. And anyway, so my writing then was on all, you know, various subjects of ethics and the failure of the accounting profession to hold chartered accountants to account. You know, chartered accountants were at the coalface of, are at the coalface of corruption, and how many of them have stood up and done the right thing? In fact, whether it's state-owned enterprises or whether it's the CAs at African Bank, failures there, or at Steinhoff, I mean, or at Hewlett's, I mean, it's everywhere. But how many chartered accountants do you see getting hammered? None. You know, people close ranks, and I think that's wrong.
Well, absolutely. And we've actually, now that I think about it, we very seldom find that there have been one or two big firms, one of the big five, in fact, collapsed. But that was internationally. That wasn't South African.
Yeah.
Because of their complicit behavior and basically theft and fraud. Ironically, what's happened with the Auditor General coming in, a good 10, 12 years ago, you said 10 to 2012. I think it might have been
I think
it was
about 2017. I think, you know, companies like SAA were audited by Pricewaterhouse up until about 2016, 2017. And then I think Kimi Makwetu took over as the AG.
Correct.
And now there's a new AG. Correct, yeah.
And since then, people have been failing their audit. The real problem is, at least the auditors are coming in. Those are state auditors, and they somehow don't have fear. I don't know why, but and none of them have been taken out, but they do fail. I mean, I'm thinking of the Department of Employment and Labor, where both the UIF and the Compensation Fund have failed completely. Now, we're going to take another ad break, but we're going to log off completely and then log back on in a minute's time.
Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Thank you. You're back with Michael Bagram every Tuesday evening between 6 and 7. Please, if you have any comments, on WhatsApp 061-895-1019 or email. It's bags, B-A-G-S, at chaifm, one word, .com. I'd like to hear from you. We do have some interesting comments. Sometimes it's a brickbat, but that's fine. I'm happy. I've got a thick skin. Please let me know what you think and whether you are happy with our programs and who you want us to interview. Well, tonight we're with a wonderful guest. We've introduced him already. It's Simon Mantell, M-A-N-T-E-L-L. He was the founder, entrepreneur behind Mantelli's Biscuits. He's been through a lot of his background and how he got to Mantelli's. We've discussed that. What we haven't discussed actually is the move into some kosher Mantelli's products, and I'm going to ask him about that now before I continue, because I've been interacting with him and been marveling at some of his adverts for Mantelli's Biscuits that have a political bent, a really wry sense of humor and great sarcasm. But Simon, sorry, I'd forgotten to ask you, I eat your kosher biscuits. What got you onto that? And tell me how they're selling and what's the favorite product there?
So, you know, in fact, our factory is completely kosher. It's not just some products, everything that we produce. So the factory is a kosher factory. And what happened was many years ago, I got invited to a wedding and I met a guy called Ivan Epstein, who at that, he had just retired. He'd been the CEO of Beacon Sweets and Chocolates. I think he That was, I think, when it was still owned by the Zulmans. And he had moved down from Durban, and he was at the wedding with his wife. And we got chatting, and we got chatting about kosher. And then he introduced me to an amazing guy called Rabbi Mazels.
Ah, yes, wonderful.
That's how the process began, and we became kosher. And so ever since then, probably since about 2002, I think our products have been kosher since then.
Was a great guy. He's passed on, Rabbi Mazels.
Yes,
wonderful person.
He really was. He used to come, obviously, he originally sort of koshered the factory, and came and did a few inspections, and he'd pop in from time to time. But he really was just this amazing, amazing person. He was
extremely learned, by the way, the scriptures and the Old Testament, and just a great storyteller as well. I miss him really a lot. I didn't know that, actually.
Yeah.
Well done to you. Okay, sorry, I had interrupted you on this background of your adverts and your involvement in writing a little bit about politics, picking out the people. We had spoken a little bit about the complicity of the auditors, but I must tell you, and I've got to point fingers at myself, the lawyers, the attorneys, also a lot of these big businesses somehow were over the, what they were doing was wrong, and their attorneys were giving them ways and means of skirting the edges and sort of gilding the lily somewhat, to put it nicely. And I know that. I've seen that on many occasions. And the attorneys are aiding and abetting some of this fraud and corruption that's happening. And yet we've seen no attorneys being taken on at all. They disappear. They're shrinking violets. They disappear as soon as they hit the pan. Yeah.
Well, if you think about it, let's say if you take typically in government procurement as an example, generally it's big corporates that can do business with, they have products or services that government needs. And yes, maybe they might insert a tenderpreneur into the process. And there's all sorts of skullduggery going on there. But with all of these things, there are agreements that are drawn up. And if it's a big company, I'm thinking of the companies, I think ABB was the Swiss instrument control company that was involved in ESCOM, and I know the government's recovered billions from them, and whoever it was, whether it's Thies Crippen in the arms deal, the big legal firms are producing the legal contracts. And what should actually happen is they should say, look, that sort of work we don't do because we know it's tainted with malfeasance, and walk away from it in exactly the same way. I can understand a big audit firm maybe worrying about their audit clerks and partners being whacked or whatever. But the point is, in the big audit firms in the sort of the early 2000s should have said, look, we're not going to audit the SAEs. We're not prepared to do it.
Yeah, correct.
Just look at the way FNB, I remember doing a radio advert on that many years ago. I don't know whether you can remember when the Department of Education couldn't give school books to the kids in Limpopo and Mpumalanga. There was that thing about school books, and FNB was critical of it. I think they had some comment to make. And the next thing, government threatened to withdraw. The municipalities have banked with FNB, and the guys backed down. I think that big business has to put their head over the parapet, and they need to speak up. It's no good carrying on like we are now. And unfortunately, what happens is there are very few people in big business who are going to actually tell it like it is.
Well, now we've just had an incident now where the retiring CEO of Capitec has accused government of overestimating unemployment by saying that he thinks unemployment in South Africa is actually at 10%, and we've all ignored the small informal businesses. And he probably could say that because they're the bank for the people. And those people who don't have formal jobs are still banking and still saving. And he's probably getting, and he almost backed down. He hasn't. He almost backed down because there was a lot of fallout against Capitec. I don't know if you've been watching that story.
Yeah, well, actually, I wrote an opinion piece on it for BizNews, that piece. And in fact, you know, my view on it is that that's smoke and mirrors. You know, maybe they can extract that information from the 24 million odd account holders that they've got. But the reality is that all those jobs in the township, it's subsistence jobs. Excuse me, the person selling fruit or a tuck shop or got a little mini Shabin at home or doing exhausts or fixing motorbikes for the Ubers or someone owning a few Uber delivery bikes. They don't have, and this gets back to this thing of education. You know, in order to build a business, you need to be financially literate and numerous. And yes, you can work things out in the back of a cigarette box, but you can only do it for so long and at a certain size. If you want to scale up, you have to have a better understanding of things. And as long as we have an education system that produces people that are illiterate and innumerate, yes, there might well be economic activity in the townships where they are, but they're like subsistence farmers. And you know, for us to thrive as a nation, we've got a young population. Imagine if this young population, this natural resource that we have, was well educated. Imagine if government, the ANC, took it seriously, and every kid in the township.
Can I put you on hold? Can I put you on hold for 1 minute? Keep that thought. We're going to come back to it. 1 minute. We've got to pay the bills again.
Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
Thank you. You're with Michael Bagram and my wonderful guest, Simon Mantell, the founder and owner of Mantelli's Biscuits. You're telling us that biscuits were kosher biscuits. I think they're absolutely wonderful. But we now have moved on and we're talking about his thoughts and theories and writings on politics in South Africa. Now, you ended off just before we rudely cut into you. Do you want to just finish that thought and I'll go on to the next step?
I was talking about education. So really the point is the people in the townships that are hustling, yes, they are hustling and they're kind of getting by and they're putting food on the table. But, one of the things about life is people need to have hope. And the reality is that if your education is so poor that your understanding, your literacy and numeracy is so weak, you can't really get absorbed into the mainstream economy. And, you know, the way, you know, if you look at what blue collar work of 50 years ago versus blue collar work of today is completely different, even though it's blue collar work, you know, you need that numeracy. And what I see, you know, and I can appreciate the outgoing CEO of Capitec. He visits the townships and he knows his customer. I'm not disputing that. But what I am disputing is I often, from time to time, I see potential job applicants knocking at our factory looking for work. And they've got no hope. You know, and this is the thing. We've got this young population. What should happen in an idea, we talk about the Constitution, but what should happen is that every kid in this country should have the equivalent of a Model C education, and that should be non-negotiable. And within the townships, even if the schools become these oases of hope and positivity, where the kids can maybe, if they're then having to get one or two meals a day within that safe environment, but it's not like that, you know, and what you then see is you see the gap, and I see it, the gap between the kids have gone to Model C or private schools, and then people who've been in a township school where literally, I think a grade 11 or grade 12 education is probably the equivalent of grade 7 at a Model C or private school. You know, the gap is just that so big. And that is the biggest crime of our current government is that we've let down these people who actually they have no future. Just because, and I think that what happens is when Gerrie Fourie of Capitec says employment's only 10 or 12%, it's a get out of jail card for the government.
Yeah, and even they attacked him. They went for him as well. Almost to the extent they wanted him to withdraw the statement. It's actually quite weird.
Yeah, look, you know, and, you know, so I just think that that should be our priority. You know, it's the youth of the country. And, you know, we can talk as much about equal rights and constitution, but if you don't give young people an education, they have no chance, no chance. And I just see it. I see 20, 25-year-olds who've in theory grown up in democracy, but in fact, I would argue that the education that they received is far worse than anything in the dreaded apartheid days. It's far, you know, they're just not equipped.
Yeah, that's pretty sad. I want to change tact slightly, if you don't mind. You've been writing quite a bit for the Daily Maverick, Business Day, and whatever, but you had one interesting topic. You were looking at the NPA and some of those, because the fraud and corruption is today so high-tech, that fraud. It's sort of, you need to be an auditor almost to understand what's gone wrong and where the money's gone and how it was stolen. I mean, for me, as a simple attorney, I just, some of these things, I don't understand how they even got the money out. It just was far-fetched. But you were saying how the NPA just doesn't have the skills and they're not going to get it right as much as we push them. Can you try and expand a bit on that?
Yeah, so it was a piece I actually wrote quite a long time ago. It might have even been in COVID when I wrote that. But really what it is, you know, the NPA is only as good as the hawks or the police or the investigators. So if the investigators aren't capable of investigating, well, then the NPA is actually, they're working with nothing. And then, I mean, I have a case where I'm a complainant dealing with the hawks or the DPCI. And I just see I've got a very capable colonel who's investigating, but he's got 30 or 40 cases he's dealing with. I mean, he's just so snowed under. And so what my thinking was that, and I gave the analogy of Rassie Erasmus, when he took over the Springbok rugby team, I think in 2017, we were a bunch of losers. We were getting hammered and thrashed by the All Blacks and all and sundry. And his first thing was almost to win ugly. You know, he kept the game was played in the forwards, Fuffed a clear, kicked up and unders. And, well, we won the World Cup like that. And then since then, obviously, things have evolved. But he simplified things. And really what because I've been a witness to corruption. In fact, it isn't that complicated. It's more that they just aren't, the detectives don't have enough time to investigate matters. That's really, I think, one of the big issues. I don't think the crime is that complicated. But really, my logic was to say, let's make it simple, a little bit like Rassie saying, we're just going to play with our forwards and our number nine and kick for position and maul and score tries. My thing was to say, let's hammer directors and more important, and as importantly, non-executive directors, whether it's in listed companies, because typically that's where people suffer when things fail. You know, if I go out of business, I might affect one or two creditors if I've behaved negligently or recklessly. But when you're a listed company like African Bank or Steinhoff, and you do things negligently, you affect people's pensions. And really what it is to say, well, go prosecute these people, not with big corruption crimes, but just prosecute them in terms of their disclosure in the financial statements. And, you know, there are various sections of the Companies Act which say you must disclose figures correctly in the financials and you take responsibility for them. So if you look at Steinhoff, what should have happened is that the Steinhoff directors, the non-executive directors as well, should have been prosecuted in terms of breaching the Companies Act for failing to produce accurate financial statements. Simple.
Thank you. I'm going to have to stop you there because unfortunately we're running out of time fast. What I do need you to do is, if you're willing to do it, share your email address and maybe contact details if people want to get hold of Kosher Mantelis.
Sure, I'll do that. Pleasure. Well, thank you for the kind words. I must say, you flatter me.
Yeah. Please let us know. What's your email address?
Sure. It's Simon, S-I-M-O-N, at Mantelis, Mantellis.com.
Thank you, because in the past I haven't asked people to share, and then it's all come back to me. So thank you very much for sharing your time with us. I know you're a hell of a busy. I know you're writing all the time. So I really appreciate it. You've spent an hour with us. You've given us an insight into a fledgling business that's grown into a big business today, if I might call it that, and a very successful business.
Not a big business.
So thank you very much, and I really appreciate you giving me your time. Thank you.
Pleasure, Michael. Thank you very much.